going to review this morning, and that we hoped you would be able to pick up in the bookstore if you were interested, is Buckner's Telling the Truth. The Gospel is Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale. And if you can't get it here and you're turned on by this, maybe you'll want to get it somewhere because it's delightful read.
The interesting thing is I don't know anything about this guy's pedigree. I don't know who he is. Does anybody know who he is?
I know he's Presbyterian.
Is he? Mm-hmm. He handles the Gospel better than most Presbyterians. Buckner. What, Frederick?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'd call him Fritz, and he's got a good German name. Spell it for us.
B-U-E-C-H-N-E-R.
Buchner, huh? Did I say it right? And the publisher is Harper and Row, of all people, you know. They don't ordinarily publish thin volumes of religious thought, but that's what this is. It's well done. I know of nothing else he's written, do you?
Well, it lists a couple here. A Long Day's Dying and
yeah.
Open Heart.
Yeah. Open Heart. Sounds surgical. and frightening. Just to maybe lead us into this thing, some systematic theology for starters. Have you ever started your day on systematic theology before?
Not for a long time.
You may never wish to do that again after this. The term that needs definition here is gospel. Here's how we Lutherans think about it. We think about the Word of God being the big thing. Boy, this is hard, Chuck. And then we think about dividing the Word of God into law on one side and gospel on the other side, okay? And we're fussy about making that distinction between law and gospel. And I think that's a very, very important theological insight, to think that to begin mixing these two together is to get yourself into all sorts of theological tangles. And what happens when you mix them together and don't make, as the Lutherans say, a proper distinction between law and gospel, the gospel is always the loser, because the law can always come through very strong for us. Okay, important Lutheran distinction in theology. The law being what God tells us and demands of us, the sort of behavior God demands of us, that's law. A good sentence to remember is, the law always accuses you. So if you are feeling accused by what the preacher said at any point in his preaching, what you're getting is law, okay? The gospel, on the other hand, is the message of salvation. The good news is what God has done for you in Jesus Christ, our Lord, okay? So that distinction, very important one. Now we come to this point. You say he's Presbyterian, okay? This good Presbyterian, he does not make this distinction. When he uses gospel, as he does in the title of this book, Telling the Truth, the Gospel as Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale, he's using gospel, I think, in a much broader sense. Like that. Gospel equals message from God. So he's not making that distinction. The part about gospel as tragedy, pretty much this division over here that we Lutherans make and call law. But it's not quite. And this use of the word gospel to equal Word of God, total Word of God, I find is a rather common one in Christendom. If you go out, as I have occasionally, to talk theology in ecumenical circles, and you say the word gospel, they do not hear this, as we Lutherans do. They hear this. And you get into all kinds of fights with Baptists and Presbyterians about that. Terminological difference is all we're doing, I think. So, let me start us off with this little guy. He says, really, in the outset of this, that this is a book about preaching. But carefully note, it is not a book for preachers only. He sees preaching as not something that is done by preachers. Important insight, I think. Preaching is something that is done
by Christian people. Even if it's, if you got one guy, you know, the way the German Lutherans do it in, where, Wisconsin and Minnesota, they put the pulpit way up in the altar, in the top of the reredos behind the altar. Where?
Nebraska also.
Nebraska also, okay. That sort of setting makes preaching look like it's something one person does. Wrong. Preaching is something that goes on between. If we can hang on to that, then those of you who don't stand up in a little box way up there and do that will feel all right about what we're up to today. Preaching is something that goes on between preacher and congregation. Start us off here. The gospel is bad news before it is good news. See what I mean? It is the news that man is a sinner, to use the old word. We'd call that law, wouldn't we? That he is evil in the imagination of his heart, that when he looks in the mirror all in a lather, what he sees is at least 8 parts chicken, phony, slob. That is the tragedy. But it is also the news that he is loved anyway, cherished, forgiven, bleeding to be sure. An earlier image in the book is Beecher, the famous preacher, getting ready to deliver some lectures, and he cuts himself shaving, so he's bleeding. Bleeding to be sure, but also bled for. That is the comedy. And yet, so what? So what if even in his sin the slob is loved and forgiven, when the very mark and substance of his sin and of his slobbery is that he keeps turning down the love and forgiveness because he either doesn't believe it, or doesn't want them, or doesn't give a damn? In answer, the news of the gospel is that extraordinary things happen to him, just as in fairy tales, extraordinary things happen. Henry Ward Beecher cheats on his wife, his God, and himself, but manages to keep on bringing the gospel to life for people anyway, maybe even for himself. You see how he's gotten tragedy, comedy, and fairy tale already woven into our language. Zacchaeus climbs up a sycamore tree, a crook, and climbs down a saint. That's the fairy tale part of it. Paul sets out a hatchet man for the Pharisees and comes back a fool for Christ. It is impossible for anybody to leave behind the darkness of the world he carries on his back like a snail. But for God, all things are possible. That is the fairy tale. Altogether, they are the truth. Then, a word about preachers, and maybe something that could happen to those of you who are not preachers as you read this thing, or maybe even as you listen to me today, is you begin to see the spot the preacher's in. It's a spot I know about, and it's a spot some others in the room know about who are preachers. But to the preacher, the gospel is not just to tell the truth, but to tell the truth in love. And to tell the truth in love means to tell it with concern, not only for the truth that is being told, but with concern also for the people it is being told to. So it is crucial to keep them in mind too, the hearers of the tragic, the comic, the fairy tale truth. Who are they? What is going on inside them? What is happening behind their faces, where they have cut themselves to make them strain to hear the truth if it is told? The preacher must always try to feel what it is like to live inside the skins of the people he is preaching to hear the truth as they hear it. That is not as hard as it sounds, because of course he is himself a hearer of truth as well as a teller of truth, and he listens out of the same emptiness as they do for a truth to fill him and to make him true. Ben, you were going to pick up right there.
At the deepest level, all hearers of the truth are the same hearer. When I try to picture him or her, what I picture is the one who is famous for having asked to hear. He took a long drag on his cigarette, narrowed his eyes, and asked, "What is truth?" One might do worse than to start with him. The man I'm talking about is Pontius Pilate, of course.
Now, I have to ask you to bear with me. I have a long section I want to read, several pages, but what I want to have happen to you is what happens to you if you read this book at this point. What he does is he kind of he draws Pontius Pilate with clear enough lines that you can see yourself there. That's basically what he's up to. You begin to see Pontius Pilate in 20th century dress, but all the first century motives are still there, and they're not different from our 20th century motives. I walk you through this, and I know it may get a bit tedious, with the intent in mind that you would catch it and be able to see yourself in Pontius Pilate. He is the... Gee, if you stand up, nobody can see you.
That's right.
Let me just get back a little ways. I thought I could do a better job if I'd stand up, but you'll have to take me sitting down. He is the procurator of Judea. On the day that he asks his famous question, there are other things, too, that he has seen and done. He makes his first major decision before he has even had his breakfast, while still in his pajamas. He walks downstairs to the bar closet, where he keeps extra cigarettes, takes the 2.5 cartons that he finds there, and puts them out with the trash. So that's the start of Pilate's day. There is the remains of a pack in the pocket of his dinner jacket and some loose ones lying around the house in various cigarette boxes. All of these he carefully destroys, slitting them open with his thumbnail and flushing that tobacco down the toilet. After dinner the evening before, the talk turned to politics. He was up for hours, talking and smoking, so that when he awoke, his tongue felt hot and dry, his whole chest raw inside like a wound. He knows about the Surgeon General's warning. He has seen the usual photographs of smokers' lungs. He has been a 3-pack-a-day man for better or for worse than 30 years. So his pre-breakfast decision is a decision for life against death. And he sees it as his death that he slits open with his thumbnail and flushes away. It's a good start. He feels better for it. Not even the morning paper upsets him. Leafing through it in the back seat of the limousine as he is driven into the city, it contains the usual grim recital: poverty, crime, disease, corruption in high places, ignorance and superstition and indifference in low places and everywhere else. But he feels for the moment wonderfully insulated from it as the car rolls along and he glances out at the world from time to time through the tinted windows. Notice how 20th century he is. Children are playing in the streets. Heavily armed policemen patrolling the seedier neighborhoods. Sightseers feeding pigeons outside the temple gate. He is essentially a law and order man, and he is maintaining them as best he can. If the malcontents, the eggheads, the bleeding hearts want to carry on about rottenness at the heart of things, that is their business. His concern is the rottenness in the streets, and his business is to keep the ship afloat from day to day. All in all, he is not doing a bad job of it. There are no major complaints from Rome. The Jews are happy enough with their Jewish puppets, and he himself, if not exactly happy, is happy enough. When he was a young man, he dreamed of greater things than a provincial procuratorship. There. But he could have done a lot worse. He is Caesar's friend. His sons have had the best education money could buy. His wife is subject to troubling dreams, but she is in the hands of a good analyst. Their marriage is not what it once was, but she lets him go his own way, and he has found other ways to go. He comforts her by saying that the day is not far off when they can retire to the villa outside Ostia to enjoy visits from the children and grandchildren, the evening martini, the walk along the beach. But in the meantime, he has appointments to keep, and he keeps them. The chief of the occupational forces, this would be the head of the army there, is in a sweat because the high holidays are upon them, and he expects trouble from the fanatics. The Jewish god, not knowing which side his matzo is buttered on, wants Rome out, wants the peace that passeth all understanding for his people instead of the Pax Romana. Pilate starts to search for a cigarette and then remembers. He picks up a pencil instead. He says that what passeth his understanding is the Jews themselves, who have never had it so good. He says that what passeth his understanding is how they can go on knocking themselves out for a god who runs history, when it is precisely history that has run over them and left them with their ancient superstitions as much an anachronism as an Egyptian mummy or a stone axe. Besides, he says, Caesar is God. The chief of the occupational forces is a straight party line man with an eye on promotion. And Pilate does not quite permit himself a wink as he says it. Caesar is God, he says, with only the faintest flicker of a smile. It is not returned, and he orders the guard doubled around the temple and the whole garrison put on alert until the Passover passes over. The tax people come in with the usual excuses. You can't get blood out of a stone, they say, and you can't make a Roman silk purse out of the ear of a Jewish sow. A man comes in with a scheme for an aqueduct to solve the city's water problem. It will pass through land, which he is prepared to sell at considerable personal sacrifice. There is some kind of epidemic in the old slave district, and there are complaints about bodies left in the street to draw flies and packs of orphan children scavenging among them for food. There has been some kind of demonstration at one of the city gates with some upcountry messiah at the center of it, and the whole question is how to handle it without making it worse. The Jews are playing it safe by passing the buck to Caesar, and there is no God, and Caesar is his name, Pilate permits himself to say this time, but only to his secretary because she is young and pretty and stupid and won't get it anyway. He says he will see the man himself if that's what they want. If they want him to see their God, he'll see him too, the more the merrier. The secretary lowers her eyes under his steady, bland gaze like a girl in a convent. But he has reason to know that if there was ever a convent, she has come a long way since and wouldn't need more than a nod from him to come a good bit farther still. He is tempted for a moment to give her that nod, but is deterred by his knowledge that a man needs as much singleness of purpose to be unfaithful to his wife as he needs to be faithful to her, and for the moment, the only purpose he can bring himself to take seriously is lunch, which he eats quickly and alone at his desk. Roman beer, cold chicken with mayonnaise, two hard-boiled eggs, and if smoking doesn't get him, he thinks cholesterol will. He is already older than his father lived to be, and bad hearts run in the family. When he is through eating, he would trade the Ostian village for a cigarette, but cigarettes are death, and he has flushed them all away for the sake of life. It is a sacrifice, he hopes, that will prove worth the making. A phone call comes through from his wife. She tells him that one of the horses has gotten foundered and has to be put down. She doesn't give a hoot about horses, but as she runs on and on about it, all of a sudden her voice goes clear and thick and he realizes that she is weeping. He can see her sitting there with the receiver cradled between her ear and her shoulder so that she can light a cigarette as she always does when she starts to cry. He can almost smell the smoke as she lights it and then starts talking again. He closes his eyes and tries to think of something to distract him. But nothing comes. She is apologizing for bothering him, for weeping, apologizing for her life. She has had a bad night, the same dark dreams. As she talks, he swivels around in his chair to look out the window behind him. Down in the courtyard, a ragged child is talking to one of the soldiers, and she wonders if it can be one of the epidemic children, the disease clinging to its clothes like lice. A pigeon perched on the windowsill fans one wing out, then tucks it in again. When his wife finally hangs up and he swings back to his desk, he finds he is no longer alone. They have brought the upcountry Messiah in for questioning. Pilate is caught off guard, and before he knows what he's doing, he takes a cigarette from the onyx box on his desk and lights it. Finally, we've solved that one. The man stands in front of the desk with his hands tied behind his back. You can see he has been roughed up a little. His upper lip is absurdly puffed out, and one eye is swollen shut. He looks unwashed and smells unwashed. His feet are bare, big, flat, peasant feet, although the man himself is not big. There is something almost comic about the way he stands there. Notice he introduces that word. Slightly bent forward because of the way his hands are tied and goggling down at the floor, through his one good eye as if he is looking for something he had lost, a button off his shirt, a dime somebody slipped him for a cup of coffee. If there were just the two of them, Pilate thinks, he would give him his car fare and send him back to the sticks where he came from. But the guards are watching, and on the wall, the official portrait of Tiberius Caesar is watching, the fat, powdered face, the toothy imperial smile. So he goes through the formalities. So you're the king of the Jews, he says, the head Jew, because there hasn't been one of them yet who hasn't made that his claim. David come back to give Judea back to the Jews. The man says, it's not this world I'm king of, but his accent is so thick that Pilate hardly gets it. the accent together with what they have done to his upper lip. As if he had a mouthful of stones, he said, "I've come to bear witness to the truth." And at that, the procurator of Judea takes a long, deep drag on his filter tip that makes his head swim. And for a minute, he's afraid he may faint. He pushes back from the desk and crosses his legs. There is a papery rustle of wings as the pigeon flutters off the sill and floats down towards the cobbles. Standing by the door, the guards aren't paying much attention. One of them is picking his nose, the other staring at the ceiling. Cigarette smoke drifts over the surface of the desk. The picture of his wife, when she still had her looks, the onyx box from Caesar, the clay plaque with the imprint of his first son's hand on it, made while he was still a child at nursery school. Pilate squints at the man through the smoke and asks his question. He asks it half because he would give as much as even his life to hear the answer, and half because he believes that there is no answer and would give a good deal to hear that too, because it would mean just one less thing to have to worry about. That's interesting. Pilate is pictured as really asking that question, is not being just a rhetorical, sarcastic question, as I think most of us have come to think of it. When Pilate asks Christ bound before him, "What is truth?" This author gives Pilate the benefit of the doubt and says he's really asking a real question. He would like very much to hear the truth, if such a thing can be heard, and if it cannot be heard, he would like to hear that as well. He says, "What is truth?" And by way of an answer, the man with the split lip doesn't say a blessed thing. Or else, his not saying anything, that is the blessed thing. You could hear a pin drop in a big, high-ceilinged room with Tiberius grinning down from the wall like a pumpkin, that one cigarette a little unsteady between the procurator's yellowed fingertips. The one who hears the truth that is silenced before it is a word is Pilate. Once more, the one who hears the truth that is silence before it is a word is Pilate, and he hears it because he is asked to hear it. And he is asked to hear it, "What is truth?" he asks, because in a world of many truths and half-truths, he is hungry for truth itself, or failing that, at least for the truth that there is no truth.
We are all of us Pilate in our asking after truth. And when we come to church to ask it, the preacher would do well to answer us with silence, because the truth and the gospel are one. And before the gospel is a word, it too, like truth, is silence. Not an ordinary silence, silence is nothing to hear, but silence that makes itself heard if you listen to it the way Pilate listens to the silence of the man with the split lip. The gospel that is truth is good news. But before it is good news, let's just say that it's news. I think we need to talk about that part then.
Yeah, that's a little tricky.
A lot of words.
He sets the whole scene, draws us in, makes each of us Pilate in our own way, I guess, and then says that what Jesus says when asked to speak the truth is silence. And the point he would make, I think, is that is made right here. Before it's the good news, it is just the news. And at the gospel, I think what he's doing, and it's a good thing to have happen to us Lutherans, who, you know, can do this gospel number like I did on the board before, so easily. And, you know, we know what the gospel is, and we know how to divide it into parts and, you know, throw it up on a wall. And what he's saying is the gospel is not a theological dictum. Gospel is what is. The good news, before it is the good news, is just news. The gospel is what is. And so here stands Jesus before Pilate and before each of us who, like Pilate, searches for the truth. And Jesus stands before us, first silent, giving no answer to our bald question, "What is truth?" Hoping that we can stand there and behold him who is truth as something that is before it is words strung together.
I think something you said to me last night that made some sense when we talked about this was, you said, people are always searching for truth, but truth is just what is. It's what is. It's good and bad, the way Buchner says. And the gospel is what is. It's what God has done. And then you put those two in the same basket.
Yeah.
Is the gospel what is, or a sign of what is?
If gospel is a bunch of words about Jesus, mm-hmm. then it's a sign of what is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. That helps.
If you're considering gospel, this is, you know, these four books or three books,
four.
However you do it, then it's got to be a sign and not a statement or a description of what is. I mean, that's the point.
Yeah.
I take it,
yeah. The point that he makes, and he makes you search for it, I think. He made me search for it. I didn't know where that was going. I was intrigued by all the Pilate stuff, as I think a lot of people would be. You know, that's really kind of clever, and he winds you all in, pulls you in on that. But then he's got the hook set in your mouth, and you didn't get the worm yet. And the point of it is that gospel is not an idea. Gospel is what is. And there he stands with the split lip. The Christ he pictures here before Pilate is both tragic and comic, isn't he? I mean, he's a bumpkin. Caesar may have a face like a pumpkin, but the guy standing in front of Pilate is a bumpkin, a country bumpkin. Somebody you would feel sorry for, if anything. You would say, oh my goodness, you know, pat him on the head and send him back to the North Country where he came from. Send him back to the sticks. That's where he belongs. He's no kind of great threat. He's a nothing. Thus, the Christ is depicted. Tellingly, I think. Everybody get any idea about the silence? The message of that silence is the gospel, before it is good news, is just news. It is what is. And before it is any kind of news we blab about, the gospel is what is.
Jesus is tragic from some sort of human perspective.
But yes.
And there's a kind of comedy about it from a divine perspective when you recognize that what we've taken to be tragedy is all redeemed in the ultimate.
You're catching it. Yes, you are. What a great joke God has pulled on all of us. Huh? And to be able to laugh at it. Before we get to that, I need to look at the tragedy, and before we get to the tragedy, I got a little section here on the preacher. And we're back to where we started, thinking about what the preacher's task is like and what's going on there. So the sermon hymn comes to a close with a somewhat unsteady amen, and the organist gestures the choir to sit down. Fresh from breakfast with his wife and children and a quick run-through of the Sunday papers, the preacher climbs the steps to the pulpit with his sermon in his hand. He hikes his black robe up at the knee so that he will not trip over it on the way up. His mouth is a little dry. He has cut himself shaving. He feels as if he has swallowed an anchor. If it weren't for the honor of the thing, he would just as soon be somewhere else. Those of you who are preachers will know what this is talking about. Those of you who aren't will just have to believe, but it's true, is it not? In the front row, the old ladies turn up their hearing aids, and a young lady slips her six-year-old a lifesaver and a magic marker. A college sophomore home for vacation, who was there because he was dragged there, slumps forward with his chin in his hands. The vice president of a bank who twice that week had seriously contemplated suicide, places his hymnal in Iraq. A pregnant girl feels the life stir inside her. A high school math teacher who for 20 years has managed to keep his homosexuality a secret for the most part, even from himself, creases his order of service down the center with his thumbnail and tucks it under his knee. Pilate is here. The aqueduct man is here, who has indicated that he will make it worth his while if his people get the contract. And Henry Ward Beecher is here. It is a busman's holiday for him. The vestry has urged him to take a week off for a badly needed rest, and he has come to hear how somebody else does it for a change. It is not that he doesn't love his wife. I should fill you in on that. The book begins with a portrait of Henry Ward Beecher about to make the lecture on preaching. And he comes to New Haven to do that, well aware of the fact that he's been caught in his adultery, and cuts himself while shaving. It's not that he doesn't love his wife, but just that, pushing 60, he has been caught preposterously off guard by someone who lets him open his heart to her, someone willing in her beauty to hear out the old spellbinder, who as a minister has never had anybody much to minister to him. King Lear is here, with a bit of egg dried on his tie and weak kidneys. The preacher pulls the little cord that turns on the lectern light and deals out his note cards like a riverboat gambler. The stakes have never been higher. 2 minutes from now, he may have lost his listeners completely to their own thoughts. But at this minute, he has them in the palm of his hand. The silence in the shabby church is deafening because everybody is listening to it. Everybody is listening, including even himself. How about that as an interesting way to characterize the silence that precedes the sermon? What I usually do is listen to my own heartbeat. Boom, 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 boom. and thank the Lord that it's still going. Everybody knows the end of things. Everybody knows the kind of things he has told them before and not told them. But who knows what this time, out of the silence, he will tell them. And so the congregation and the preacher involved in the same kind of expectation that he will have the truth for them. Then, on to tragedy. The gospel as tragedy. We Lutherans would call this law, but it's interesting to put it together. The pressures that are on the preacher now. There are all kinds of pressures on the preacher, both from within and without, to be all kinds of other things and to speak all kinds of other words. To speak the truth with love is to run the risk always of speaking only the truths that people love to hear you speak. How about that, preachers? That catch any of you up short? I think it does me. And the preacher's temptation, among others, is to deal with those problems only to which there is, however complex and hard to arrive at, a solution. The pressure on the preacher is to be topical and contemporary, to speak out like the prophets against injustice and unrighteousness, and it is right that he should do so, critical even. And if he does not go to righteous action, he fails both God and man. But he must remember, the ones he is speaking to are beneath all the clothes they wear. They are the poor, bare, forked animals who labor and are heavy laden under the burden of their own lives, let alone of the world's tragic life. Then, let's see. I was going to go a little farther with that. There is the one who can't stop thinking about suicide, the one who experiences his own sexuality as a guilt of which he can never be absolved, the one whose fear of death is only a screen behind which lies his deeper fear of life, the one who is in a way crippled by her own beauty because it has meant that she has never had to be loving or human to be loved, but only beautiful. The angry one, the lonely one. For the preacher to be relevant to the staggering problems of history is to risk being irrelevant to the staggering problems of the ones who sit there listening out of their own histories. That's very nicely said, I think. To be relevant to the staggering problems of history is to be irrelevant to the staggering problems of the ones who sit there listening out of their own personal histories. To deal with the problems to which there is a possible solution can be a way of avoiding the problems to which, humanly speaking, there is no solution. When Jesus was brought to the place where his friend Lazarus lay dead, for instance, he did not offer any solution. He only wept. Then the other things he said and did. But first, he simply let his tears be his word. A section on Jesus and his own death. Later in the garden, when it was his own death, he had to sweat out. We are told he sweated blood. He said, "Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me." And the cup was not removed from him, presumably because the Father was not willing to remove it. And one suspects that the unwillingness of the Father may have been harder for Jesus to choke down than the cup itself was. Later, it was harder still. By the time he had been hanging there for a while, he had no tears left to weep with, and no more sweat, his tongue so dry that he could hardly wrap it around the words, which are among the few words he ever spoke that people remembered in the language he spoke them in, probably because, having once heard them, they could never forget them, no matter how hard they tried. And probably they tried hard and often. "My God, my God, why have you?" And then the Aramaic verb from the Arabic root meaning to run out on, to leave in the lurch, to be the hell and gone. "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? My God, where the hell are you?" Meaning, "If thou art our Father who art in heaven, be thou also our Father who art in hell," because hell is where the action is, where I am, where the cross is. It is where the pitiless storm is. It is where men labor and are heavy laden under the burden of their own lives without you, where they cut themselves shaving and smoke 3 packs a day, though they know the Surgeon General's warning by heart. Now you're seeing the tragedy, huh? And the tragedy has to do with, I think, right here. What is the tragedy for Jesus? The same as the tragedy for us. The absence of God. The absence of the truth. That little section that I just read you about the Garden of Gethsemane and the crucifixion, I think very powerfully speaks to me about absence of God. This was the nature, says Buchner, of the intense suffering of Christ. And wonderfully for us, of the intense identification with our suffering. You know, it's not just being afraid to die, it's not just being afraid of pain or of suffering pain. It is of no God to hear your prayer. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Just a little more on that. The absence of God is not just an idea to conjure with, an emptiness for the preacher to try to furnish like a house with a chair and a sofa, heat and light to make it livable. The absence of God is just that which is not livable. It is the tears that Jesus wept over Lazarus, and the sweat he sweated in the garden, and the cry he choked out when his own tongue filled his mouth like a gag. The cross that is a symbol of defeat before it is a symbol of victory speaks also of the absence of God. And Jesus speaks of it. He says, "Seeing they do not see and hearing they do not say, they do not hear." He says, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." And on the cross, as far as we are told, no sign was given him either. Just a sponge soaked in Dago red. And a word of cold comfort from the good thief who asked to be remembered in his kingly power. Asked him who died without the power to raise spit and looked less like a king than like a street accident. he says, my God, why have you left me holding the bag, holding the world, when I can hardly any longer hold up my head? Jesus shares with us the darkness of what it is to be without God, as well as showing forth the glory of what it is to be with God. He speaks about it, and perhaps that is much of why, although we have not followed him very well these past 2,000 years or so, we have never quite been able to stop listening to him. We've not followed him, but we've never been able to stop listening to him. We listen almost in spite of ourselves when he tells us the ship is sinking with all hands aboard. All of you labor and are heavy laden, he says. There's the gospel as tragedy, and the cross as defeat before it is victory. The sight of things that we tend to miss sometimes, but the sight of things, the sight of the gospel. And now I'm using the word in Bickner's sense to include all Christ did, which is, I think, his meaning for it. Then let's move out of that, which is pretty heavy stuff, and into the gospel as comedy. We had a glimpse of that in the comic, almost Chaplin-esque portrayal of Christ before Pilate, with the fat lip and the swollen eye, and his hands is, you know, stooped over because his hands are tied up high behind his back. We begin the section of the gospel as comedy with a portrayal of somebody you know. Let's see how quickly you can recognize her. This is a game. The place to start is with a woman laughing. She is an old woman, and after a lifetime in the desert, her face is cracked and rutted like 6 months without rain. She hunches her shoulders around her ears and starts to shake. She squinties her eyes shut, and her laughter is all china teeth and wheeze and tears running down as she rocks back and forth in her kitchen chair. She is laughing because she is pushing 91 hard and has just been told she's going to have a baby. Oh, she is. And even though it was an angel who told her, she can't control herself, and her husband can't control himself either. He keeps a straight face a few seconds longer than she does, but he ends by cracking up too. Even the angel is not unaffected. He hides his mouth behind his golden scapular, but you can see something in his eyes. They are larkspur blue and brimming with something of which the laughter of the old woman and her husband is at best only a rough translation. The old woman's name is Sarah, of course, and the old man's name is Abraham. And they are laughing at the idea of a baby being born in a geriatric ward and Medicare picking up the tab. They are laughing because the angel not only seems to believe it, but seems to expect them to believe it too. They are laughing because with part of themselves they do believe it. They are laughing because with another part of themselves they know it would take a fool to believe it. They are laughing because laughing is better than crying, and maybe not even all that different. They are laughing because if by some crazy chance it should just happen to come true, then they would really have something to laugh about. They are laughing at God and with God, and they are laughing at themselves too, because laughter has that in common with weeping. No matter what the immediate occasion is, either your laughter or your tears, the object of both ends up being yourself and your own life. Interesting insight. They had had quite a life, the old pair. Years before, they had gotten off to a good start in Mesopotamia. They had a nice house in the suburbs with a two-car garage, a color TV, and a barbecue pit. They had a room all fixed up for when the babies started coming. With their health and each other and their families behind them, they had what is known as a future. Sarah got her clothes at Bonwitz, did volunteer work in the hospital, was a member of the League of Women Voters. Abraham was pulling down an excellent salary for a young man, plus generous fringe benefits and an enlightened retirement plan. And then they got religion, or religion got them, and Abraham was convinced that what God wanted them to do was pull up stakes and head out for Cana, where God had promised he would make Abraham the father of a great nation, which would in turn be a blessing to all nations. So that's what they did, and that's where their trouble started. They put the house on the market and gave the color TV to the hospital and got a good price for the crib and the bassinet because they had never been used and were as good as new. Abraham wrote an eloquent letter of resignation to the president of the company and received an equally eloquent one in reply, assuring him that there would always be a job waiting for him if he ever changed his mind and came back. If he ever regains his senses and came back was the way the president expressed it in the first draft, because even though he thought religion was a good thing, like Social Security and regular exercise, he didn't think it was something to go overboard about like Abraham. But in his final draft, he settled for the milder wording. So off they went with their station wagon and a U-Haul behind, and a handful of friends and relatives, who, if they didn't share Abraham's religious conviction, decided to hitch their wagon to his star anyhow. Among the people they took was their brother-in-law, Lot. It turned out to be a bad mistake. Then there's a little section here about the two Yiddish words, shlemiel and shlemazel. And he carefully explains that a shlemiel is the kind of guy who goes around pouring soup on people, you know, by mistake, accidentally, just, you know, can't do anything right. And a shlemazel, that's the guy who gets soup poured on him. And he identifies Abraham as a shlemazel. He's the kind of guy who, you know, just goes from one disaster to the next. So the years rolled by like an empty perambulator. Those of you who don't know what that is, that's a baby carriage. Until finally, when Abraham was 100 and Sarah was 90, the angel arrived to make his shattering announcement. He said that when God made a promise, he stuck to it, and Sarah was going to have a boy. Then they laughed. One account says that Abraham laughed until he fell on his face. The other account says that Sarah was the one who did it. She was hiding behind the door of their tent when the angel spoke, and it was her laughter that got them all going. According to Genesis, God intervened then and asked about Sarah's laughter, and Sarah was scared stiff and denied the whole thing. Then God said, "No, but you did laugh," and of course he was right. Maybe the most interesting part of it all was that far from getting angry at them for laughing, God told them that when the baby was born, he wanted them to name him Isaac, which in Hebrew means laughter. So you can say that God not only tolerated their laughter, but blessed it, and in a sense, joined in it himself, which makes it a very special laughter indeed. God and man laughing together, sharing a glorious joke in which both of them are involved. It is perhaps as important to look closely into the laughter of Abraham and Sarah as it is important to look closely into the tears of Jesus. I like that. So there we have the beginning of comedy. A little touch here about comedy as different from tragedy. The tragic is inevitable. The comic is unforeseeable. How can Donald Duck foresee that after being run over by the steamroller, he will pick himself up on the other side as flat as a pancake for a few seconds, but alive and squawking? How can Charlie Chaplin in his baggy pants and derby hat foresee that although he is stood up by the girl and clobbered over the head by the policeman and hit in a kisser with a custard pie, he will emerge dapper and gallant at the end, twirling his invincible cane and twitching his invincible mustache? Bored to death by his comforters and scratching his boils and facing the undertaker's unpaid bill for the multiple funerals of his children and entire household staff, how could Job possibly foresee with his bloodshot eyes that his bloodshot eyes would indeed behold, and by no means as a stranger, the one who laid the foundations of the earth and whose work the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? So, tragedy is inevitable and highly predictable. Comedy is not. Comedy is the opposite of that. I lost my place here for a minute. Yeah, here we go. Who could have predicted that God would choose not Esau, the honest and reliable one, but Jacob, the trickster and the heel? That he would put the finger on Noah, who hit the bottle, or on Moses, who was trying to beat a rap in Midian for braining a man in Egypt, and said if it weren't for the honor of the thing, he'd just as soon let Aaron go back and face the music. Or on the prophets, that God would choose the prophets, who were a ragged lot, mad as hatters, most of them, and dragging their heels to a man when they were called to hit the sawdust trail. Who could have foretold that out of the sordid affair between David and Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, Solomon would be born, with his high IQ and his passion for ecclesiastical architecture? And of course, there is the comedy, the unforeseeableness of the election itself. Of all the peoples he could have chosen to be his holy people, he chose the Jews, who, as someone has said, are just like everybody else, only more so, more religious than anybody when they were being religious, and when they were secular, more secular, being secular as if they had invented it themselves. And the comedy of the covenant, God saying, I will be your God, you shall be my people, to a people who, before the words had stopped ringing in their ears, were dancing around the golden calf like aborigines and carrying on with every agricultural deity and fertility god that came down the pike. Read the Old Testament sometime. That's what it's about, isn't it? And yet it was this people who produced as their greatest king but one, a king who danced another dance altogether. David the king, stripping himself down to his fig leaf, and to the unmixed horror of his aristocratic wife, dancing like a madman before the ark of the Lord, because more than most, he got the wonderful joke of it all. Jesus says, come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden. That's the tragedy. Then he says, and I will give you rest. That's the comedy. And the comedy has to do with both Jesus as a speaker and the gospel he speaks. At the last meal he ever ate with his friends, when the goon squad was already laying for him in the shadows and all hell was about to break loose, the great confidence with which he says, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world, becomes the great confidence of Charlie Chaplin as the little tramp standing there so jaunty and hopeful in his baggy pants and derby hat, while the whole world he has overcome threatens to crash down on him like a pail of water balanced on top of the door. When finally they string him up, they do so for the wrong reasons, and string him up as a nationalist revolutionary when the only revolution he is after is a revolution of the human heart, and his concern is ultimately for all nations. Even the resurrection has a kind of comedy to it. His closest followers dismiss it out of hand as an old wives' tale, and when Mary Magdalene comes upon him in the dim half-light of dawn, she mistakes him for the gardener of all people. The red marks on his hands are where he is holding roses. The trouble he is having with his feet comes from the miles of patrolling the gravel walks to pick up the gum wrappers with his pointed stick. The comedy of all this is not the black comedy it might at first seem to Jew and Gentile alike, who have learned of the world to see all things as black at first, but it is white comedy, the high comedy of Christ, that is as close to tears as the high comedy of Buster Keaton or Marcel Marceau or Edith Bunker is close to tears. But glad tears at last, not sad tears. Tears at the hilarious unexpectedness of things rather than at their tragic expectedness. Do you get that at all? Buster Keaton, that kind of comedy. Marcel Marceau, that kind of comedy. Which, when I see it referenced here, realize that the comedy of Marcel Marceau had always offended me. You know, it never worked for me. I wasn't laughing. I was torn. And what was getting me about Marcel Marceau was the comedy was so close to tragedy in him. Edith Bunker I can laugh at sometimes, but, and there's probably a comic we know better than Buster Keaton or Marcel Marceau. But isn't Edith Bunker's comedy often with a sad tinge to it? But in the end, she can laugh and rejoice at all the ridiculous things that are going on around her and her own involvement in them. Are we getting anywhere with Christ as comic?
You might think of a proverb of Blake. It says, the excess of sorrow dance.
Okay.
And there's something, I mean, in Chaplin or Aristotle or Edith Bunker. The best example I can think of is these films aren't circulated very much anymore, but the films of Jacques Tati.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
It's too bad they're not shown more often, but it seems to me that that really.
Do any of you know the films of Jacques Tati? Mr. Hulot's Holiday is the one, the most famous one, I think. I would pay $5 to see that right now. he is easier to identify with than Chaplin. You know, Chaplin's Little Tramp is funny, but it's pretty much outside myself. Jacques Tati in Mr. Hulot, there's a couple of them, I think, portrays somebody who is not that different from me when I make a damn fool of myself, which is occasional, I think. but close enough to home that you can see, you know, you can identify with his foibles, and they are always disastrous. The one I'm remembering is Mr. Hulot's Holiday. He goes to the seaside for a brief vacation by himself, this very strange man. And one of the first things he does is rent a boat to go paddling. And he's always pursuing other people. He's wanting friendship with people, so he's trying to wave and at other paddlers. He's in a strange boat, which is a folding boat, you know, the kind you can fold up in the middle and put on top of your car. And here he is, and he's paddling along with his double-ended oar, I think, and just having a good time and waving to people and being weird. And then the boat begins to fall in the middle. And the last shot in that scene is this thing totally closed with the paddle sticking out on both ends going down.
My God.
You have about 10 minutes left and you have a lot more stuff. I don't know.
Okay. This next section here plugs into some of the stuff Myron has been leading us through this week in terms of parables, and my own stuff on Capon, was talking about the parable of the wedding feast. I suspect that Jesus spoke many of his parables as a kind of sad and holy joke, and that may be part of why he seems reluctant to explain them, because if you have to explain a joke, you might as well save your breath. I don't mean jokes for the joke's sake, of course. I mean the kind of godly jest the preacher starts his sermon with to warm people up and show them that despite his Geneva tabs and his cassock, he can laugh with the rest of them and is as human as anybody else. You know what that's about. I mean the kind of joke Jesus told when he said, "It is harder for a rich person to enter paradise than for a Mercedes to go through a revolving door." How's that for an update? Harder for a rich man to enter paradise than for Nelson Rockefeller to get through the night deposit slot in the First National City Bank. And then added that though for man it is impossible, for God all things are possible, because God is the master of the impossible. And he is the master of the impossible because in terms of what man thinks possible, he is in the end a wild and impossible God. It seems to me that more often than not, the parables can be read as high and holy jokes about God and about man and about the gospel itself as the highest and holiest joke of them all. Does God answer the prayers of man? Jesus says, if your 10-year-old asks you for a goldfish, do you give him a black widow spider? If he comes to you for an Eskimo pie, do you knock out his two front teeth? It is almost as if he is saying, a foolish question deserves a foolish answer, the foolishness of what we preach. Elsewhere, as Jesus tells it, the comedy about God deepens and becomes even more antic and unexpected, which would seem to be part of what comedy is all about. The parable of the talents, for instance, which we heard about last night from Jeanette. The five-talent man puts his five talents on Beautiful Dreamer to come in first in the fifth in Saratoga and doubles his money. The two-talent man gets his broker to buy him two shares of United Distillers, and when the market goes up, does as well as the five-talent man. The one talent man, on the other hand, plays it safe and with good reason. As he explains it later, he knows that his benefactor is a hard man, and in terms of the way things turn out for him, he's dead right. It's the all or nothing one who are held up as shining examples of what it is to have faith, to have life, to have courage, or whatever it takes, and the better be safe than sorry ones who get it in the neck for taking faith or life or courage or whatever it is he's been given and tucking it under his tail and sitting on it like an old sitting on it like an old grad on a hot water bottle on the 50-yard line of the chili October 7th. God is the comic shepherd who gets more of a kick out of the one lost sheep once he finds it again than out of the 99 who had the good sense not to get lost in the first place. God is the eccentric host who, when the country club crowd turns out to have other things more important to do than to come and live it up with him, goes out to Skid Row and soup kitchens and charity wards and brings home a freak show. The man with no legs who sells shoelaces at the corner, the old woman in the moth-eaten fur coat who makes her daily rounds of the garbage cans, the old wino with his pint in a brown paper bag, the pusher, the whore, the village idiot who stands at the blinker light waving his hands as the cars go by. They are seated at the damask-laid table in the great hall. The candles are all lit and the champagne glasses filled. At the sign from the host, the musicians up in their gallery strike up Amazing Grace. If you have to explain it, don't bother. And here he does the prodigal son. The prodigal son goes off with his inheritance and blows the whole pile on liquor, sex, and fancy clothes. He disagrees with you. Until finally he doesn't have 2 cents left to rub together and has to go to work or starve to death. He gets a job on a pig farm and keeps it long enough to observe that the pigs are getting a better deal than he is, and then decides to go home. There is nothing edifying about his decision. There is no indication that he realizes he's made an ass of himself and broken his old man's heart. No indication that he thinks his old man as anything more than a meal ticket. There is no sign that he is sorry for what he's done or that he's resolved to make amends somehow and do better next time. He decides to go home for the simple reason that he knows he's always got 3 squares a day at home. And for a man who's in danger of starving to death, that's reason enough. So he sets out on the return trip and on the way rehearses the speech he hopes will soften the old man's heart enough so that he won't at least slam the door in his face. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be your son. That will hit him where he lives, if anything will, the boy thinks. And he goes over it again. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Trying to get the inflection right and the gestures right. And just about the time he thinks he has it down, the old man spots him coming around the corner below the tennis courts and starts sprinting down the drive like a maniac. Before the boy has time to get so much as the first words out, the old man throws his arms around him and all but knocks him off his feet with his tears and whiskers and incredulous laughter of his welcome. The boy is back. That's all that matters. Who cares why he's back? And the old man doesn't do what any other father under heaven would have been inclined to do. He doesn't say he hopes he has learned his lesson and I told you so. He doesn't say he hopes he will finally be ready to settle down for a while and will find some way to make up with his mother. He just says, bring him something to eat, for God's sake. Bring him some warm clothes to put on. And when the boy finally manages to slip his prepared marks in edgewise, the old man doesn't even hear them. He's in such a state. All he can say is the boy was dead and is alive again. The boy was lost and is found again. And then in the end of the scene, what Jesus has tell her of the parable says is, they began to make merry. Merry of all things. Turn on the stereo, break out the best scotch, roll back the living room carpet, and ring up the neighbors. But that parable, as joke, puts maybe a slightly different light on it. The whole gospel as joke, then on to the gospel as fairy tale, and what this is about is, the gospel is fairy tale-like in that people really get what they always were looking for, which is kind of the motif of the fairy tale. A fairy tale that he deals with at some length is one we're all very familiar with. It's probably the American fairy tale. It's Wizard of Oz. And he points out that the Tin Woodsman gets his heart, the Scarecrow gets his brains, the Cowardly Lion gets his courage, and Dorothy gets back to Kansas. Another one is Beauty and the Beast. The end of that story, the beast gets beauty and becomes beautiful himself. Good and evil meet, but contrary to our usual experience, good and evil do battle, and evil loses and good wins, always in the fairy tale, right? That's how fairy tales end, and they live happily ever after. But he says, not only in the fairy tale is it like that. But that's a theme in life. It's part of what is in you and in me. And then the rest of it is, it's part of what is in God. But listen to this. You wake up on a winter morning and pull up the shade, and what lay there the evening before is no longer there. The sodden gray yard, the dog droppings, the tire tracks in the frozen mud, the broken lawn chair you forgot to take in last fall. All this has disappeared overnight, and what you look out on is not the snow of Narnia, but the snow of home, which is no less shimmering and white as it falls. The earth is covered with it, and it is falling still in silence so deep that you can hear its silence. It is snow to be shoveled to make driving even worse than usual, snow to be joked about and cursed at, but unless the child in you is entirely dead, it is snow, too, that can make the heart beat faster when it catches you by surprise that way, before your defenses are up. It is snow that can awaken memories of things more wonderful than anything you ever knew or dreamed. The joy beyond the walls of the world more poignant than grief. Even in church, you can catch a glimpse of it sometimes, though church is apt to be the last place because you are looking too hard for it there. It is not apt to be so much in a sermon that you find it, or the prayers, or the liturgy, but often in something quite incidental, like the evening the choral society does the Mozart Requiem, and there is your friend, Dr. X, who you know thinks the whole business of religion is for the birds, but he's singing the Kyrie like a bird himself. Lord, have mercy, as he stands there among the baritones in his wilted shirt and skimpy tux, and his workaday basset hound face is so alive with, if not the God he wouldn't be caught dead believing in, then at least with his twin brother, that for a moment nothing in the whole world matters less than what he believes or doesn't believe. Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison. And if at snow, dreams, certain memories, at fairy tales, the heart leaps and the eyes fill. Okay? That kind of truth. Gospel as fairy tale, and then let's weave it a little closer to the gospel with one quick paragraph. Like the fairy tale world, the world of the gospel is a world of darkness, and many of its great scenes take place at night. The child is born at night. He has his first meal in the dark at his mother's breast, and he has his last meal in the dark too. The blinds drawn, and everybody straining to catch the first sounds of heavy footsteps on the stairs, the first glint of steel in the shadowy doorway. In the garden, he could hardly see the face that leaned forward to kiss him. And from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, the sun went out like a match. So he died in the same darkness that he was born in, and rose in it too, or almost dark, the sun just barely up, as it was just barely up again, when only a few feet offshore, as they were hauling their empty nets in over the gunwales, they saw him once more, standing there barefoot in the sand near the flickering garnets of charcoal fire. Now, the real punch of gospel as fairy tale is that it is too good to be true, what the gospel is telling us. That's the real punch of the whole thing. One more quick section here, and then I think I'll stop talking for a while. This is the concluding paragraph of the book. Let the preacher tell the truth. Let him make audible the silence of the news of the world with the sound turned off, so that in the silence we can hear the tragic truth of the gospel, which is that the world where God is absent is a dark and echoing emptiness. And the comic truth of the gospel, which is that it is into the depths of his absence that God makes himself present in such unlikely ways and such unlikely people as old Sarah and Abraham, and maybe when time comes, even Pilate and Job and Lear and Henry Ward Beecher and you and I laugh till the tears run down our cheeks. And finally, let him preach this overwhelming of tragedy by comedy, of darkness by light, of the ordinary by the extraordinary, as the tale that is too good not to be true, because to dismiss it as untrue is to dismiss along with it that catch of breath, that beat and lifting of the heart, near to or even accompanied by tears, which I believe is the deepest intuition of truth that we have. Comment. I'm done. We're having a very holy silence. Okay. The name of the book is The Gospel, Telling the Truth, The Gospel as Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale, Frederick Buechner, Harper and Row.
How do you spell it?
Buechner. Spell it the hard German way.
Is he a preacher, a pastor?
Yes, he is.
All this says is that he's a farmer.
No, but George told me.
Okay. George knows secrets the rest of us don't know.
No, George told me.
By being a farmer, so he's a Harper and all the publishers.
That's what you have to be to get published at Harper?
Well, you couldn't be published at a preacher.
Okay.
One of the things that fascinates me about particularly starting with silence and then probably going through all of this is the what he is saying translated into another idiom again seems to be the only way in which an approach can be made to people who are not ready to listen to the gospel. I think of people, colleagues who have worked among Muslims for 28 years working among Muslims and having about 8 or 10 converts now to, quote, show for it. And yet, one of the visiting with these people in their early years, we came into their house, and as soon as we came into the house, the windows, in India you have bars on the windows, not to keep people out or in, but to keep the larger rodents from coming into the house. People coming in at the bars, looking all around us. You couldn't even look out of the windows. There were so many people there. And we, who had been in an area where there had been a lot of Christians before, had sort of gotten the understanding that people didn't do that. And we asked them about it, and they said, well, we're here, and the only way, we've got to be in this comedy of being looked at, practically no privacy at all, because the moment we send them away, we're sending them much farther away than just from our own privacy.
Mm-hmm. So a silence of not verbalizing, not coming out.
Not verbalizing, people. And then just waiting. That's the other thing, I guess. Waiting until people finally come and say to us, why do you do this? They tell the story of Temple Gardner, who was a great Muslim scholar who was teaching in Cairo. He taught Islam to Muslims, and he would go through the entire year without ever raising a critical word about Islam. And at the end of the year, regularly, a number of his students would come up and say, sir, we hear you speak of our faith in this way, and yet you don't believe it. Why? And it was at that point that his silence could break. Now, I'm not sure if this is what he's saying.
I think it's parallel.
But he, in effect, I'm waiting. Until you ask me, I can't say it.
Good Old Testament educational psychology. Old Testament, something big happened. They put a bunch of rocks together, and they were told to do so. They were told to do it because then when your children come by, they'll say, hey, what are those rocks together for?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can tell them.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic educational site.
This burned me particularly. One time I was making a train trip, which is about 24 hours, and got into a compartment with a very loquacious and argumentative Hindu, and I figured, well, I can't let him argue me under the table, and so we went at it for about 12 hours of those 24. Just about a half hour before we got off the train, he said, yes, he said, this has been an interesting argument, and I don't agree with you, but there is one thing I've never been able to understand about you Christians, and that is, why do you waste your time and effort in taking care of lepers and people who have TB? Practically speaking, a leper will never become a proper member of society. And TB people, you can only get them into being sort of the walking wounded. At which point I said, oh Lord.
Why couldn't we have started there 12 hours ago?
Because of the series of films on the Holocaust this spring and a lot of discussion centered about that, in one class at the seminary we talked about, you know, how do you evangelize Jews in the whole objection to the way the Missouri Synod was doing it. But, and the stress there was to lead the kind of life that will cause them to say, how come you're like that? And then when that happens, then there's a meaningful exchange.
And maybe the wisdom from Buckner and Jesus, Jesus was asked the question by Pilate, what is truth? And he didn't answer it. He did not give an answer, a verbal answer. Instead, he let himself be beaten and dragged hither and yon and finally crucified. He did not say, ha ha, my chance, you know, unroll his scroll and begin.